The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I'm Will Appleton with an episode of Rational Security for November 27th, 2022. For today's episode, the team at Lawfare decided to cross-post this week's episode of Rational Security, a weekly roundtable podcast featuring Quincha Jurassic, Scott R. Anderson, and Alan Z. Rosenstein. It's a lively and irreverent discussion of news, ideas, foreign policy, and law. Today's episode is entitled Rational Security 2.0, the Get Off My Lawn Edition. In the episode, Anderson and Rosenstein were joined by Lawfare's two associate editors, Catherine Pompilio and Haman Hahn, to discuss the week's big national security news. They spoke about former President Donald Trump's recent announcement declaring his 2024 candidacy, Attorney General Merrick Garland's own announcement of a special counsel to take over the investigations into the former president's interference in the 2020 election, North Korea's recent launch of a new ICBM, and more. This is Rational Security.
Scott, were you one of those UVA tryhards that lived on the mall, on the lawn, on the
I lived thing? On the mall. I lived on the lawn. I was one of those tryhards.
I am so unsurprised.
It was amazing. We got to go to the bathroom outside. We had to heat our room with the fireplace. It was totally worth it.
There are objectively terrible living conditions, right?
They're better. They're not as bad as it sounds. The fireplace is kind of charming. You do have to use the fireplace because the radiator they have is like nuclear hot and makes it so one half of the room is uninhabitable.
Wait, so why did you live there?
It's an honor.
An honor.
Yeah, it's like a UVA thing. It was fun. I regret it. I made my wife stay on the lawn. We went back for my 10-year college anniversary.
Oh my God.
In the middle of the summer when it was 100 degrees outside.
Somehow still your wife too, which is impressive.
She is still my wife. It was like 100 degrees. And then we got locked out of the room in our bathrobes trying to go to the shower. And so I had to walk across a bunch of people doing yoga on the lawn to ask them to let me back into my room in like a short robe because it was designed for a normal person, not a 6'5" person like me.
I think this is good B-roll, actually. I think we should just have Scott's story about coming back to UVA.
My wonderful, beautiful, tolerant wife, who I need to say more nice things about because she feels like I only make fun of her on the podcast. So I need to say more complimentary things.
Does she listen to it?
If you can work in, she does listen to it now. Yeah, we made fun of my wife for not listening to the podcast in like episode 2 or 3 of Ratsec 2.0. And since she's listened to every episode because I made her feel guilty. And she's a wonderful, beautiful, supportive woman. And Jen, if you could put that in, that'd be great. Thank you.
So good.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Rational Security. I am one of your co-hosts, Scott R. Anderson. Thrilled to be back with you this week. And I am joined by one, but not both, sadly, of my other co-hosts, the one being Mr. Alan Rosenstein.
The worst one. Let's admit it.
That's what some people on Twitter seem to feel.
That's
really
all the
case.
The people on Twitter.
You and I are scraping bottom side by side, holding hands the whole way.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think you and I are both squarely in second place, but Quinta is the winner.
Yeah, the Quinta stands are quite vocal on the tweets, for better or for worse. But sadly, Quinta is not with us this week, as this is a holiday week, as folks are well aware, no doubt, about Thanksgiving impending upon us. We are thrilled to be joined by not one, but two other special guests. We are doing a Lawfare Associate Editor doubleheader. And we are thrilled to be joined today by Catherine Pompilio and Haman Han. Haman, Catherine, thank you so much for being with us here today.
Thanks for having us.
Well, thank you.
I can say with some confidence, I don't think you've been on Rational Security before. Because I think you both started after I took over the show. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah. Yes.
We don't have to do that awkward thing where we ask them if they were on the old Rational Security, if they liked it better than this Rational Security.
Then we have to take some digs at Ben. We can do that anyway. We don't have to this time. That's our usual traditional mode.
I like job security, so no. No, thank you.
Fair policy. Fair policy. That's the sort of kind of general subservience that we aim for as our associate editors. That's perfect.
Fear and proofreading.
Exactly. Well, we are thrilled to have you here for what we are calling the Get Off My Lawn edition in honor of my alma mater, once again, the University of Virginia and its beautiful lawn. Because we have a number of big stories from this past week, despite the impending holiday. It did not let national security professionals rest here in our nation's capital, because there's a number of big breaking stories up our alley that we want to talk about, and we want to talk about them with the two of you and our audience. Our first topic for this week, topic one, going full Cleve, Grover Cleveland, that is. Last week, former President Donald Trump announced his intention.
Deep cuts.
Deep cuts. Everybody knows that now. I feel like every op-ed about this has mentioned the Grover Cleveland parallels. Because last week, former President Donald Trump announced his intention to once again run for president. If he is reelected, he will be the first president to be reelected for non-consecutive term since, of course, Mr. Grover Cleveland. And he's doing so in spite of the Republicans' relatively weak showing in the midterm elections and his own impending legal troubles. What does Trump's announcement mean for 2024 and after? Topic two. A Mueller mulligan? Question mark. Trump's announcement that he was once again running for president in turn led Attorney General Merrick Garland to make his own announcement last Friday that he was appointing yet another special counsel, this time to take over the investigations into Trump's interference in the 2020 election results and mishandling of classified records. Was this the right move? How will the special counsel's appointment impact the investigations and Trump's political future? And topic three, Pyongyanking our chain. North Korea has launched a new ICBM that it claims can deliver nuclear weapons anywhere in the United States. Should this threat be taken seriously, or is it mostly a bluff? And is the Biden administration and the broader international community doing enough to respond? For our first topic, I will hand it over to me, because we are short on hosts this week, and I am going to go ahead and introduce a couple of topics this time. Of course, this past Tuesday, a week ago from when we were recording this, former President Trump, in a very characteristic speech of a sort that I think those of us who have been phasing out some of his public remarks for the last year or two have maybe forgotten the unique pattern and rhythms of a Donald Trump speech, of which this very much was one, announced that he was, in fact, planning to run for president again in 2024. He cast aspersions lightly on some of his other candidates, part of a longer campaign, a kind of bickering of words he's had with particular Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. He snuck in an endorsement of Herschel Walker, of course, the Senate candidate that is in a very close runoff in the state of Georgia, although control of the Senate no longer hinges on whether or not he wins. Democrats will control it either way. And he kind of glossed over, I think it's fair to say, or put a positive gloss on election results, not really seeming to concede that what many people maintained was the fact that this might not be the best moment for Trump to announce, given that by most assessments, many of the candidates he backed and his kind of wing of the Republican Party appeared to suffer some significant setbacks in midterm elections, at least particularly in those contested elections, the most high-profile elections where most of the candidates he backed lost. Catherine, let me come to you first. Tell us a little bit about how you think Trump's announcement plays into the kind of trajectory going into 2024. Is this, to a lot of ways, this isn't unexpected. I think a lot of us saw this coming. Trump really hasn't been very subtle that was his intent. Is this a big deal? Is this a medium deal? And what does it mean for 2024? Do you really think that this means that Trump is on a trajectory to win, that he's a presumptive nominee? Or is it likely to be a harder road to hoe than it was in, for example, 2020, where as the incumbent president, he was pretty much de facto the nominee for the party?
Mm-hmm. I would say I think I'm honestly just scarred a little bit from 2016 and that I'm more wary of Trump than I definitely was back then. Sometimes I feel like I have a little bit of in doing the research for this podcast, I came across a lot of articles, you know, kind of minimizing, in my opinion, like his actual chances of becoming the nominee. Sometimes I feel like I have a little bit of tinfoil on my head. Like, were you guys not here in 2016? We all kind of minimized him back then. And obviously what happened happened. So I think that he's definitely more of a credible threat than I think a lot of people are giving him credit for. And I know we're going to talk about this later, but I'm also really interested to see in how his campaigning plays into the legitimacy of the special counsel appointment. And yeah, I'm not super sure, but definitely very wary of his chances.
Yeah, I have to assume that. Well, I don't know. I mean, I agree with Catherine that there does seem to be a bit of a rush to dismiss Trump. I think part of that is because DeSantis is kind of a shiny new thing. I think part of it is wishful thinking because kind of no one really wants Trump to be the candidate in 2024. But I mean, I do think, you know, he is still very, very popular among the Republican base. I think he has something like an 80% favorability rating among Republicans. His fervent supporters have an almost religious connection to him in a way that I just don't think is true even of DeSantis's supporters. You know, DeSantis is, although certainly riding on a high wave of popularity, especially given his 20-point win in the Florida governor's race, he's still relatively untested. And there's just this such a long history of popular governors getting out onto the national stage and flaming out as, you know, they make some stupid gaffe or some scandal comes out or whatnot. I mean, how many times are we going to rely on popular Florida governors to beat Donald Trump? You know, DeSantis might not quite be low energy Jeb, but I'm not, you know, convinced yet that he can defeat Trump, especially given that Trump is not going to go out without a fight. I mean, I think you already see Trump preparing to fight a real scorched earth strategy against DeSantis. You know, he's beginning to circulate random rumors. I mean, it's just going to get super, super, super ugly. So, you know, my view is still that it is more likely than not that Trump will be the 2024 candidate. At the same time, I will say his announcement was just lame. That's kind of what struck me the most. It was just I don't know. I mean, it's obviously not the most important thing, but I want to be entertained, you know? I mean, if I'm going to have to deal with Donald Trump, at least make it fun. And it was kind of weirdly low energy. The speech was oddly coherent at times. It got into sort of foreign policy issues, which on the one hand, I mean, it's good because, in fact, in some ways, the most important thing a president can do is deal with foreign policy. So it's good, I guess, that Trump is thinking about it. But of course, I mean, like, Trump has no interesting thoughts about anything, especially foreign policy. So the whole thing was just a very strange display. And I do think Trump is maybe a little bit, there's a bit of a catch-22 here, which is that, of course, if he sticks to his old shtick, I think he's just going to keep turning off too many people. But if he tries to pivot to being a more normal candidate, it just comes out so lame that I think his base isn't really going to enjoy it too much. Now, I don't think Trump is capable of being a normal candidate for more than 7 minutes. I don't know what sort of like calm down serum they injected into him before he announced his candidacy. I suspect it'll all wear off. But that's my view. And just the, you know, more to the point, I just think the Republicans have really gotten themselves into a bad situation because I still think Trump is the presumptive nominee, but obviously his baggage is such that, you know, I think his chances of winning in 2024 are probably substantially less than in 2016 or in 2020.
You know, I think that's a good point, Alan. And just in terms of his energy in his announcement being off, it didn't seem very Trump-like. And I actually can't tell if that's because he clearly wants to run because he clearly loves being in the limelight and wants to go back to being president if he can. But a lot of this is all just so mired down, and it almost seems like he himself wasn't as excited. I think there was an energy that and a charm that kind of a crazy charm that he brought to the elections the first time around, and it worked. And so I don't know if he's going to start picking that up once he starts really campaigning and going into it, but it almost sounded like he was begrudgingly kind of announcing this presidency, which was very, very strange. And I don't know what that says about his chances for being the presumptive nominee, especially because a lot of the Republican Party does seem like they want to put some level of distance at the very least between the crazy Trump and the Jan 6 and everything else, but at the same time don't want to lose his really dedicated fan base. And I'm curious what they're going to do once Congress starts up again, and especially with the January 6th committee, whether they're going to mark that territory and say we're to kill that, or if they're going to let it go through, and what that says about their willingness to stay close to the Trump camp. So I am also a little bit cautious about whether he will be the presumptive nominee this time around, because it does seem like the midterm elections gave us a little bit of hope that the Trump message is not going to carry everyone to the very end.
Yeah, I'm going to jump in. I guess I will be the other voice of, I don't know if it's a reason, but whatever the other end of this the spectrum is here. I think Trump has a real uphill battle to get the nomination this time. I think we all have maybe been a little too, have a little too much recency bias in regards to Trump's influence over the Republican Party, which while it's been very strong for the last several years, as is often the case, frankly, with like any party leader, and the president is almost universally the party leader these days in American politics, I don't think it's quite absolute, and it hasn't been around that long. This movement that he's in charge of is very different from what the Republican Party looked like in 2014 or really even in 2016. Again, remember, he won by essentially splitting the other votes in most of the early states in the Republican primary. He secured 25-30% of the vote. And the Republican Party, it's worth noting, has actually changed its primary process somewhat to make it less winner-take-all. I can't remember exactly what formula it's kind of like splits the difference, as I recall, with the Democratic Party, at least I think in early states. But I could be mistaken about that. Something actually I want to look into. The key point being, you know, I'm not sure recapturing that magic in that moment is that easy. Among other things, that the fact that Trump, you know, may not have the energy level, he's got these personal legal concerns that are going to feature very prominently in the next 2 years and are going to be very real. I mean, he is, I would put smart money on it, going to be criminally indicted, at least at the state level in the state of Georgia. At least people close to him will be if he is not personally indicted. But again, they do have audio of him personally lobbying the Secretary of State to find additional votes. So he's personally very implicated there. I wouldn't be surprised if he's also personally implicated in the Mar-a-Lago documents investigation, where, again, there's very clear evidence of his personal involvement. That's a big departure from a lot of other investigations he's been involved in the past, whether it's Ukraine, whether it's January 6th, where you just don't have quite that last connection gap. Real liability coming out of New York in terms of investigation of his business practices and practices of the Trump Organization. I don't know if that'd be individually focused on him, but the organization, I think, is a big issue. And on top of that, you just see his views of him within the Republican Party sliding. Only 60% of the Republican Party, Republican voters and Republican-leaning independents, which are in some ways more important, actually had a warm view of President Trump at all coming into the midterm elections. This is in October 2022, I think, when this Pew research was indicated. This has been a kind of gradual decline, shrinking down from something in the 70s a year or so ago, a year and a half ago, down to the 60s and continues to decline. And a lot of those numbers, the reason why you get the 60% is because he's got very positive numbers among his traditional demographics, people who aren't college educated, people who are overwhelmingly white, slightly lean male, but not too much, people who are older, over the age of 50, much stronger demographics there. Everybody else, and those are growth and more motivated elements of even the Republican Party, but also the electorate more generally, really his numbers are far lower. So I think there's a lot of opportunity here for people to really contest his election. Are they going to do that by really taking on his narrative of the big lie regarding 2020? I kind of suspect not, although I hope some of them do. I think it would be better for the Republic generally if they make that an issue. But I think they're going to take him on as a three-time loser, somebody who's led the Republican Party to a historic defeat in 2022 that bucks the trend of midterm elections for most parties. And so all those factors combined, I have to say, I think he's going to have a rough go of it. I think that's why his advisors, at least reportedly, were saying, don't announce now. Let's wait for at least this blow to begin to fade into the memory a little bit and see the terrain before we make this big announcement. And he decided to go forward anyway. So that's my sense of things. I'm much more bearish on his chances, it sounds like, than the three of you.
These are all excellent points. The only thing I would make is that what I think you are describing is in particular the reason why Republicans should not nominate Donald Trump. But that is different than whether they will nominate Donald Trump. And my worry is that his hardcore base is so committed to him that if the other Republican politicians and if the Republican Party could, as an institution, right, in the party decides tradition that we all thought governed primaries until 2016, if they could all get behind a particular figure, maybe Ron DeSantis, for example, right? Or I don't know, like DeWine. I mean, there are others. Then I do think you could potentially, you could potentially have the kind of one-on-one showdown in which Trump could be defeated. I mean, again, whether or not you could do that in a way that would then preserve the Republican coalition for the general election is a different question. But at least then maybe you could defeat Trump in the primary. But I just don't think that the Republicans are going to coalesce around a Trump alternative, right? I mean, there's going to be DeSantis, but I think Pence is probably going to challenge. There might be other folks that are going to challenge. Oh, and the Republican Party itself is just utterly disorganized, right? There's no party statesman. It's not like George Bush is going to come in and broker in the way that Obama did for Biden, basically, in 2020. Or, you know, Kevin McCarthy's going to come in and have any impact. And so, you know, my worry is that if you're going to still have a somewhat fragmented set of challengers to Trump, he's just going to keep winning these pluralities. But, you know, we'll see. You know, obviously, Scott, you're absolutely correct, and especially with respect to the legal troubles, which don't, you know, directly prevent him from running, but, you know, might actually make him even more popular with his base, right? I mean, they might give him the energy he needs to go to his people and say, you know, look at the Democratic Party and Biden and the deep state. They hate me and they hate you, and they're willing to do this witch hunt to attack our great movement. You know, I think we don't know how the indictment is actually going to play out at the primary level.
I'd also just like to add to that. I think that this was mentioned, I think, by Quinta in the last episode of RatSec, but Trump's base just didn't show up in the midterms like they do in presidential elections, which I think definitely impacts that. And I'm afraid, or I worry, that Trump could use, you know, the Republican kind of disappointment in the midterms to motivate his base even more to come out in the general election. He said in his speech, you know, America's comeback starts now and your country's being destroyed before your eyes. So that, coupled with, you know, completely dismissing, like the big lie, completely dismissing an indictment or any other investigation, I think could totally rally a base that was probably a little bit more relaxed this time around.
Just one small note on that. I actually think, if I recall correctly, what Quinta was quoting was the narrative coming from people in the Trump camp asserting that's why he lost.
Oh, okay.
I haven't seen any data actually saying that that's the case. Actually, turnout was really high among Republican voters for a midterm election generally. And I haven't seen exit polling or something else that would give us a good way to differentiate, you know, more Trump-oriented supporter Republican voters from other Republican voters. But, you know, if overall turnout was pretty high for midterm election, not as high as a presidential election, that's never the case. You know, the thing that really proved to be disadvantageous is that the turnout was way higher among those who are concerned about reproductive rights and, you know, democratic process concerns, and generally were younger voters. Those were like the big surge to the polls that really seemed to sway things these times. And I don't know what we know what motivated those voters. I agree. I mean, you're going to get more people turn out who are motivated by individual candidates, and there are probably more people who feel that way about Donald Trump than feel that way about Joe Biden, probably, if he's the nominee for the Democrats in 2024, who knows? But a lot of people also feel that way against Trump. So I want to see more data before I really buy into any of those narratives that there's a secret wave waiting just at Donald Trump's beck and call in 2024 that for some reason he couldn't get out in 2022.
I do have a question for you, Scott. I'm curious before we leave this topic. So, I totally get your skepticism of Trump's chances here. So am I right to assume then that you think that if it's not Trump, it's almost certainly DeSantis? And if so, I'm curious why you think that. I mean, is it because DeSantis is just sort of the next person who's most popular at the moment? Or do you think DeSantis really has certain gifts that make him likely to be able to sort of thread the needle in being, you know, Trumpish, but not too Trumpish?
I don't think it's going to be Ron DeSantis either. I don't know. I'm not saying it won't be Ron DeSantis. I don't, this far out from an election, it is foolhardy to really get a sense of particularly untested candidates without national support bases to really know who's going to be the nominee. Look at polling numbers for almost every major party nominee that we've had from an open slate, like when you don't have an incumbent here, you know, it's always really competitive. Trump being a like pseudo incumbent here complicates that a little bit, but I have to say, I think that it is really, you know, a bit of an open field at this point. And there are a lot of other candidates with a lot of pluses who are very ambitious and have been waiting for a moment where they can make something like this work. Nikki Haley is the one that jumps out to my mind. She really carefully crafted a path through the Trump administration that's friendly enough to pull you know, maybe support from people who are friendly to the Trump administration, different enough and has a different enough record prior to the Trump administration to pull in maybe some more moderate voters. She's, you know, a woman. She is a person of color. She has a lot of factors that can pull in that might help in different places. From a southern state that's increasingly competitive and that the Republicans kind of need as part of their arc of support. There's a lot of factors going for a lot of other candidates. It's just too early to give it to anyone. And that's part of the reason why I think assumptions that Trump is going to be the nominee are just too much hindsight, not enough foresight.
This is related, but probably not as closely. I am curious what everyone here thinks about the fact that Trump chose not to join Twitter again, even though he was invited by Sir Elon Musk to do so. What does that say about, I feel like the Twitter was kind of his podium for getting his supporters in, and genuinely, it's a genuine question about whether he has the energy to really pull everyone back into this next run. What does that say about him and where he's at in terms of his reelection campaign?
Yeah, that's an interesting question of why he's not back on Twitter. My understanding, and I don't remember, Scott, did you tell me this or did someone else tell me this, is that he may be contractually obligated to Truth Social to not post stuff on Twitter unless he also posts it on Truth Social. I think he also has a lot fewer followers now on Twitter than maybe he used to. I don't know if his follower count is the same, but I do agree with you. I do agree with you, Heyman. I mean, Trump is maybe the greatest master of earned media in American history. And a lot of that came from saying crazy things on Twitter and then getting the news cycle to obsessively follow that. And so I do wonder if he can't get back on Twitter, if he can't get that attention back, will he be able to drive the news cycle? Though then again, I mean, it's not like journalists aren't on Truth Social. I mean, every time you post something crazy on Truth Social, someone just screenshots it onto Twitter.
Sure.
So, you know, I do wonder if he needs Twitter that much anymore. But it's an interesting point about losing, at this point, voluntarily, this kind of amazing mouthpiece.
Right. I mean, people used to track him and say Trump tweeted, and it was almost like a king's decree or something so direct, and people really took his word at face value on that site. And I mean, I just checked right now, he has 87.6 million followers. Oh, okay. And you can actually see his profile still. So it's there. The last thing he's tweeted.
That's a lot of followers.
It's a lot of followers. I think that I'm just very curious. I mean, maybe Scott will come in with the contractual legal obligations that he might have to not be on Twitter. But in all seriousness, I really do think that his Trump Twitter presidency was particularly effective in driving his agenda and really getting people to bite onto the bait that worked with his followers. So the fact that he's not really coming triumphantly back on, and Kanye did, is just a very interesting set of developments, I think.
You know, I have read in the media that there may be contractual issues here and that may be a barrier. I kind of doubt they're that serious, because Truth Social is an organization run entirely by sycophants of Donald Trump, like by matter of definition and purpose. So I can't imagine they would actually like pose serious litigation risk if you were to do something like go back on Twitter. But more fundamentally, I actually kind of suspect the significance of Twitter is frankly, like a bias built into people who are particularly strongly on Twitter and who disagree with Donald Trump more specifically. I mean, there's a long time when we thought the Donald, remember the like kind of Reddit sub forum, was in fact the big forum for organizing among Trump supporters, particularly during the early primaries. There's been a bunch of different avenues here. He's still got, you know, lots of very kind of far right OAN and news type networks, you know, broadcasting videos. He still gets speeches. He still gets talking heads on those places that reach his core supporters. And I don't think he was ever a guy who's ever really found his mission is in reaching out to people and reaching broader audiences. So in terms of his core supporters, I feel like he's just got the avenues of communication he has there. And going on Twitter now, you know, looks like he's kind of making himself beholden to Elon Musk a little bit. And I kind of suspect, you know, Trump is a guy driven by gut and instinct and like an overabundance of pride. And I kind of suspect that's the thing getting in the way. But I'm not sure it actually matters that much in the long run.
Do you also think that people are just kind of tired of it, or we're just used to it? Like Alan made the point that he's still saying these crazy things on Truth Social. And if you really wanted to see them, you know, you could. And journalists are on there looking at them. I think, you know, a lot of the appeal and a lot of the attention that he got the first time he ran was because you know, it's the first time a presidential candidate had ever said crazy things along the lines of what he had said. And now, you know, not to minimize it, but sometimes it's just kind of like, oh gosh, it's Trump again, you know?
I do think there's some of that. I mean, I think that the news media in particular has gotten much better and has developed certain antibodies against letting Trump totally drive the news cycle. I think that's true for the mainstream / leftish news media. But I think it's also true of a lot of right-wing news media. I mean, especially the Murdoch news media. I think after the announcement, there was a lot of media reportage about how, you know, Fox News is very negative on Trump and the Wall Street Journal is negative. The New York Post had, you know, great anti-Trump pun headlines like Trumpty Dumpty. That was pretty good. So, you know, I do think that is part of it. And I also think that, you know, the thing with Trump, I mean, he has the most name recognition of maybe any American politician in decades. Right. And so just this point, you know what you think of him. And so I wonder if it's just there's just very little he can say that can move any needles. So all of it might just kind of be baked in.
Well, of course, former President Trump's announcement last week was just one of two big Trump related announcements we got. The other came from Attorney General Merrick Garland, who on Friday, a kind of Trump Friday moment, something those of us in Lawfare have not really experienced in a couple of years as regularly, although we used to do it quite regularly, but kind of a late Friday Trump announcement that he was nominating an individual by the name of Jack Smith, a longtime prosecutor, most recently an international criminal law prosecutor based in The Hague with a pretty interesting international tribunal there, as a special counsel to take over the oversight of ongoing Justice Department investigations into Donald Trump relating to interference in the results of the 2020 elections of various stripes and also the mishandling of classified documents, most notably at the Mar-a-Lago estate, although I don't actually know if it's, we know it's entirely limited to that. Let me start with you on this, Alan, as our former Justice Department colleague. How big a deal is this, and what does it seem like was motivating Garland's decision to make such a visible move, particularly so soon after Trump's announcement, in a way that I'm not sure the optics would be ideal, all other things being equal? You know, was there a legal reason why the Attorney General felt like he had to make this move or was strongly advised to take this move? Was it a strategic decision? And where do we think it goes? How do we think it fits into this broader picture for 2024 and more generally our democracy?
Yeah. So, I mean, just as a preliminary matter, if folks haven't gotten a chance to listen to our special emergency podcast on that we released last Friday, I highly recommend it. We had a great lineup of folks talking about this. In terms of how big of a deal it is, I mean, I'd say it's a mild to medium deal in the sense of meaningfully changing the course of the investigation. I mean, look, anything involving prosecuting the former president of the United States who is, you know, running for re-election and is presumptively the co-front runner, I mean, I think we can at least say for the Republican nomination, anything that touches on that investigation is a big deal. And given the history of special counsels, obviously we have Robert Mueller, but, you know, others, obviously, this is all a big deal. At the same time, there are reasons to think that the appointment of this special counsel is not going to fundamentally change the ongoing investigation. And this is for, I think, a couple of reasons. The first is that clearly Merrick Garland wanted this investigation in-house as long as possible, and really felt that I think his hand was forced once Trump announced his reelection, especially given that Merrick Garland's boss, President Joe Biden, has also basically said that he's going to run in 2024. Now, in announcing the special counsel, Garland said that the reason he was doing this was because kind of it's in the public interest to have some additional bit of independence. It's arguable that it's also just a conflict of interest for the Attorney General to not have a special counsel. But the point is that, you know, the fact that he waited this long means that a huge amount of this investigation has already happened. Obviously, we've been investigating January 6th since January 6th, and the investigation to Mar-a-Lago is going on for a long time. So this is unlike the appointment of Robert Mueller as special counsel, who was brought in to run an investigation. This seems to be much more an appointment of a special counsel to take over an investigation that, if not is basically done, is largely completed, or at least is well on its way, to review that and to be the person to ultimately make the decision of whether or not to kind of pull the trigger on an indictment. Though given the
how the special counsel works, ultimately that decision could be countermanded by Merrick Garland, who will ultimately have the final say in all of this. You know, the other reason I think to think that this is not going to change the course of the investigation too much, and to point Scott made in the last segment, why I think this will, you know, ultimately Trump will probably be indicted at least for Mar-a-Lago, if not also for January 6th, is just reading the tea leaves of who the special counsel Jack Smith is. You know, he is a very experienced federal prosecutor. He was at EDNY for a long time. He was the head of DOJ's Public Integrity Division. He is currently, or was until, I don't know, a week ago, the chief prosecutor for the Kosovo war crimes trial in The Hague. And, you know, from talking to people who have interacted with him, he's just a very serious, very aggressive prosecutor. He's not the person that you bring in to, you know, slow walk an investigation. Now, he will exercise his own independent judgment. There's no reason to think that, you know, he's just going to rubber stamp what's happened so far. But I do think that there are enough signs, including statements from both the attorney general and from him, that this will not slow down the investigation, that really this is done to bring in a fresh independent set of eyes, but one that is ultimately going to do what federal prosecutors tend to do, which is where there is a strong legal and factual case, bring an indictment, even if it is politically costly and messy.
What do you think the Justice Department gains by having Jack in particular do this kind of, I guess, handoff situation, as opposed to just seeing it through to the very end?
I do have to clarify also, it is not Twitter Jack, but they look weirdly alike. I don't know if you've noticed this. They have like the exact same facial hair. And so it's very, very comparable. But just because Heyman's familiar enough with him to call him Jack, it's not Twitter Jack. It's a different Jack.
It would be amazing. It would be amazing.
That would be honestly a real turn.
Given that Elon Musk does appear to be the God Emperor now, I would not surprise me if he appointed Jack Dorsey as the special counsel to decide on Trump returning to Twitter. You can imagine these interesting parallel proceedings going on in the fresh hell that we all live in. Yeah, I don't know what it gives DOJ. I mean, look, DOJ is run by rule-following order Muppets. You know, I say that not as a criticism. I am a rule-following order Muppet myself. So, like, they have their regulations. If you read when they're supposed to appoint a special counsel, like, this is obviously when you appoint a special counsel. Like, this is not that, I think, controversial. So I don't think it's that much of a what do they gain here. I think it's just, like, this is kind of what they had to do. And Merrick Garland, you know, the most order Muppety of the order Muppets, I think did this. I don't think it gains them, frankly, anything, because the people that they might want to convince of everything being above board are probably so convinced in the conspiracy theory of the bad old deep state that nothing is going to actually convince them. I mean, especially because a special counsel is not fundamentally independent of DOJ. The special counsel ultimately reports to DOJ. This is not an independent counsel. So I don't think this gains them anything, but I also don't think it costs them that much, right? It's, you know, and Peter Strzok, the, you know, formerly of the FBI, who was obviously central to the investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election, you know, he pointed out that, you know, special counsels can get spun up very quickly. So you're maybe looking at a 1 month delay, but ultimately probably not much is going to change. So, you know, this is good for the rule of law, but I'm not sure it's going to make that much of an impact ultimately on the outcome for better or for worse.
Shifting a little bit, but Trump called on Republicans to fight the special counsel appointment. What can they do about it, if anything?
I don't think they can do anything about it. I mean, they can harass DOJ. They can try to force, Merrick Garland to come and testify every 35 minutes. They can hold, you know, whomever they want in criminal contempt, though, of course, it doesn't really matter that much, since the people who have to enforce criminal contempt are the very people who will be held in criminal contempt by a angry Marjorie Taylor Greene or whoever is going to chair the House Judiciary Committee. And in some ways, and this is kind of to your point, Heyman, you know, it might help DOJ a little bit in that it gives other DOJ officials the ability, when they're going before Congress, to respond to, you know, Jim Jordan by saying, look, we're just not involved. Like, I don't know anything about the Trump stuff, the Trump investigation. That's all through the special counsel. Go talk to them. And then, of course, the special counsel will say, no, I'm not going to talk to them because I'm not going to talk to you because it's an ongoing investigation. So it's kind of a way of funneling. And the other question is, are they going, do the Republicans want to give Jack Smith a hard time for this? I mean, you know, if you follow, you know, especially Scott's logic from the first segment about this is maybe an opportunity for Republicans to get rid of Trump. They don't really want to. Then, of course, you get into these complicated dynamics about, well, if Mark Meadows has a crazy MAGA Matt Gaetz led majority, tiny majority, that's going to make his life miserable. Can he tamp down on the radical fringe elements of his caucus? I suspect the answer is no. But I don't think, frankly, the appointment or not of a special counsel fundamentally changes how much damage Congress can or cannot do to the Department of Justice.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. Want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers and that the one with the most information about me was called HLEC. I have no idea what HLEC is. So the other day, I got my latest report and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there. And these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code lawfare20.
And on this question about the relationship between the special counsel and Congress, remember that Comey decided that he would kind of keep Congress apprised of what was happening, and Mueller was kind of like, no, I don't want to do a lot of testifying. What is your sense of special counsel? I can't call him Jack anymore because I'm going to get yelled at. But the new special counsel, what do we think he's going to do? And does it matter how much interaction he has with Congress or reporting he does to Congress for the ultimate decision?
Yeah, I think that I don't want to relitigate 2016 and the decisions that then FBI Director Comey made. I do think in retrospect, they have not turned out, they don't look that great. And I don't think even Comey is particularly satisfied with a lot of the stuff that happened in 2016. I think that maybe the lesson that DOJ has learned is honestly stick to the tight-lipped procedures for a reason. So I don't expect that Merrick Garland is going to be going out of his way to provide updates to Congress, because I just think people have learned that you know, you're going to get in trouble no matter what you do. And the more you can keep it by the book, the better it is for you.
Yeah. And it's worth bearing in mind, you know, the tool that the Republican majority in the House is going to have is the oversight tool, is the ability to call witnesses, secure documents. And ongoing proceedings in regards to criminal investigations is like one of the third rails of executive privilege, or maybe the opposite of a third rail. It's like one of the core kind of pillars of executive privilege, as I recall, in terms of what the executive branch generally fights the hardest on against having to disclose for very obvious and frankly pretty well-founded reasons, right? Like, you know, you can't have people going to interfere in a criminal investigation in a variety of ways. It can be really damaging to have them do so. That's true in a FOIA context. It's true in other statutory disclosure contexts, and true by my recollection in congressional oversight as well. And so I think, as Alan noted, this lets you kind of segregate the investigation a little bit more, although obviously they're going to pull staff from, you know, the existing offices that are working on this, probably keep a lot of the existing case officers and prosecutors, precisely because they already know the case fairly well and they don't want to slow things up. But hopefully that helps a little bit. But I really think that that's going to be the main avenue of putting pressure. And it's less about actually getting at the investigation, more about undermining the credibility of the people involved, right? Because you can't really get at the facts. And the Justice Department, actually, the approach that I agree, I think Alan's 100% right, the DOJ is going to and has doubled down on about saying, we're not going to talk about anything until the procedurally appropriate moment. There are leaks, there are things that come out. Sometimes there are necessary filings that we discovered in regards to the MAL procedures, but they try not to generally. The problem with that is that gives other people the ability to shape their narrative. And that's going to be, you know, I think the House Judiciary Committee's inclination. And if Jim Jordan is the chair, which seems likely, not, I don't think that's been established yet. I could be wrong, but I don't believe so. But it's, I think, presumed to be the case. He's already acting like he's the incoming chair in terms of notifying people about, you know, hearings and potential witnesses, you know. That's the direction he's going to lean in. That may not be great. You know, again, if Trump looks really guilty for this stuff, like Mar-a-Lago hurt his reputation. You had people understanding that this is a bad thing, including lots of Republicans saying this is a bad thing, that if these facts are true, you know, digging deeper and really bringing higher emphasis to that might be a problem. So maybe they end up backing off for that reason. But it really depends on the kind of trajectory of the investigation, how it intersects with those oversight incentives and the kind of abusive oversight incentives, honestly.
Yeah. And I just want to add to the point about oversight. I mean, if I were a unscrupulous Republican head of the Judiciary Committee, I think the smarter play would actually not to be to necessarily question the integrity of the special counsel directly, but instead to use it to make more hay out of Hunter Biden and the laptop and all that stuff and say, look, you know, you appointed a special counsel for Trump, but why aren't you appointing a special counsel to investigate the son of the president, right? Who we know the president is in contact with. I think that would probably be the smartest way for Republicans to use a special counsel, not to beef up Trump per se, but to try to bring down Joe Biden, right? If you can use it as an opportunity to bring sort of everyone down into the muck, as it were, And so I would not be surprised if we see that as a tool, especially because, you know, there's some plausibility to it, right? Like, why isn't there a special counsel for Hunter Biden, right?
I will say, I think the number one reason they may not do that, this is changing topics a little bit, but I think it's an interesting thing to touch on, is that I'm not sure it's in the interest of the House Judiciary Committee for them to appoint a special counsel, for the simple reason that once the Justice Department appoints a special counsel, they've met the demand of the House Judiciary Committee, if that's the demand they're putting forward. And then all of a sudden, all of this gets put in that black box of non-communication for months and months until the special counsel finishes investigation. Their ability to shape the narrative, drive out facts, really begins to diminish substantially. I think Jordan's going to want to preserve the prerogative to drive his own investigation and shape his own narrative around those sorts of facts. And that's probably only going to be made harder if they appoint a special counsel. I frankly think I could easily see a strategic discussion where the Biden administration says, look, the best way to handle all this is actually to be appoint a special counsel, have an investigation, have somebody look at it. We're not actually worried about our legal exposure, because I haven't seen anything that suggests there is strong legal exposure here. Maybe problematic behavior and a lot of other stripes, but not actual legal exposure, which is what the Justice Department is going to look at. And once you have those proceedings and it comes out crystal clear, like, it actually kind of vindicates you. I mean, that was kind of Trump's experience with the Mueller experience. I think we all had serious doubts about how the Justice Department handled it, but they pretty effectively spun it to say, look, DOJ basically vindicated us through the special counsel process. And it really did take a lot of the air out of that issue in terms of public salience for a long time. And I think this issue is frankly, like, again, the real legal risk is far more limited than it was in that case. And maybe that makes some strategic sense for the Biden administration to think about. So long story short, I wouldn't be surprised if this is not the last special counsel we see the Biden administration establish. You know, we may yet see Attorney General Garland make one or two more of these announcements.
At the end of the day, I think it's a great subliminal messaging from Garland to have a former war crimes prosecutor being the one to take over this part of the investigation. It was just classic move. Very, very well done. But can I ask both of you to give us like a law 101 of sorts? So there are obviously separate tracks of litigation happening at once, and in addition to the special investigation. So the last deadline for Special Master Deary to finish his investigation, I believe, is at the end of December for Mar-a-Lago in particular. And so how do all these different strands come together with the special counsel in terms of timeline? And when do you think it's going to end?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the special counsel necessarily changes any of those timelines. I mean, obviously, I guess DOJ could, in some of these pending cases, ask for a little more time to bring the special counsel up to speed. I don't think they're going to do that, right? They're just going to, I mean, DOJ is good at meeting.
Definitely deadlines. Not in that case where they're trying to make things move faster.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I think this is one of these, just to get back to the kind of the original point about how this special counsel differs from the Russian investigation special counsel. You know, I don't expect this to actually change the course of litigation, right? This is basically just, you have now a new boss who needs to be read in, but ultimately is almost certainly just going to keep the investigation going at full speed. How those other investigations go, you know, we don't know. There's the Mar-a-Lago investigation. There's an appeal before the 11th Circuit about all of that. So we're going to see what happens there. We don't even have anything on the other stuff, on the January 6th stuff itself. So, the answer to your question is, I think we don't know, but there's little reason to think that the appointment of the special counsel is going to change how these investigations are going to go.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I don't think we know, you know, the end of the Deary process is just the end of the, you know, review that former President Trump has requested of these records. It's not the end of the Justice Department's investigation. It really, you know, it lifts what might be a barrier, but frankly, I think is less of a barrier than it may once have seemed to the investigation proceeding, along with the appellate proceedings, everything else that's happening in that case. Like, you know, the investigation's ongoing, but it's going to take longer. The Justice Department's going to take its sweet time. It's going to build as strong a case as it can before it reaches a decision. So I wouldn't expect, any actual motion on this from the special counsel's office until into next year. I think there's some incentive to get it done, reach a conclusion well in advance of the next election. But there's a big window there between now and then.
Okay, I think I'm going to, since Quinta's not here, I'm going to do the Quinta transition. Because there should be one per episode. From terrible things at home to terrible things abroad. Let's talk about North Korea, everyone. So
don't make fun of Quinta like this, Alan. Wow.
Why Quinta? Oh, are you kidding me? Quinta makes fun of me all the time. It's because we're such good friends. This is what we do. Quinta can get back.
Quinta will be the first to acknowledge she's bad at segues.
Yes, she will. She will be the first to acknowledge us about it. It's like a little bit we have. So let's talk about North Korea. So they fired a rocket, one of many. And as Scott mentioned at the top, this ICBM, which landed, I think, somewhere off the coast of Japan, North Korea claims could hit anywhere in the United States, and stick a nuke on top of that baby. And, you know, now it's a real party. So this is the usual North Korea missile test, though we have some additional fun quirks to it, like the publicity blitz inside North Korea about it, which is not just the usual Kim Jong-un in front of a giant missile, but Kim Jong-un and his daughter, you know, who's this like sweet, I don't know how old she is, but, you know, it's like this sweet teen in a big puffy white coat, you know, really heartwarming pictures of father and daughter, except that unlike the usual sweet picture of father and daughter, there is a World War III causing giant nuclear capable ICBM in the background. It's truly very profound iconography. So I want to start with you, Heyman. I have not thought about North Korea for months, which has been great. But that means that it'd be helpful if you could bring us up to speed. What has old crazy Kim, who is 38 years old, I read, which is just amazing. He is just, he's too young to be dragging the world into potential nuclear war. What has he been up to lately? And can you contextualize this latest missile test against just the last couple of months of North Korea?
Yeah. Well, I think one thing you said there that we should focus on is that it is usual insofar as they have been testing pretty regularly this year, more frequently than they did last year. And so that is a general reason to have alarm bells. But I always, whenever talking about nuclear weapons, like to just have a sobering kind of view as much as possible. And yes, this is terrible, but it is a little bit normal for North Korea. So they tested the Hwasong-17 ICBM technology, and they did that in response, they say, in response to the joint military exercises that the US and South Korea do pretty regularly. The biggest one that happened in recent months was in August, and that was a big deal because they had paused that for a bit to try and have better relations and think about ways to mitigate the problem overall. And so there had been a pause, but that restarting pushed North Korea to respond in testing these ICBMs again. The Hwasong-17, when they first restarted testing, failed. And then this time it was a successful launch. And so that is what is causing the Security Council to meet. And they met yesterday to, you know, come up with a resolution to condemn North Korea for having done this. And of course, Biden also asked Xi Jinping at the G20 summit to kind of use his leverage to try and get North Korea to stop testing. But this is kind of, I think, to put a broader point on it, a return to a sad normal that kind of had gone away in previous years. And it's in part due to, frankly, the Biden administration has a lot of other things going on right now. Obviously, we're in the middle of a war with Ukraine. There's the coronavirus that's still going on. There's a pandemic. There's inflation. And North Korea has actually been kind of lower down on the administration's, I guess, prospectus of what it wants to be focusing on these days. And it seems kind of like North Korea is signaling that they want more attention and really just asking them to be recognized again, because they're from the North Koreans' perspective, I think that there is a bit of an ebb and flow between administrations, right, of kind of Obama's strategic patience and then Trump's very path-breaking weird normalization effort, and now we're back to the Biden administration, more of a traditional viewpoint on we need to denuclearize North Korea, but again, with all these other things going on, there's not a lot of special attention given to North Korea. So they're starting up their testing again. And unfortunately, it is successful.
So I totally get the framing. And I agree with it that this just seems to be a lot of the same story that we hear over and over again. There's some quiet. North Korea comes up with an excuse to do something provocative. Everyone freaks out. Everyone looks to Russia and China. They do nothing. And then everyone kind of forgets about it until the next time.
Yeah.
At the same time, you know, this is, and correct me if I'm wrong, the first successful missile test of a missile that could deliver a nuclear payload to anywhere in the United States, right? We're not talking about a strike on Alaska, which would be bad, right? To be clear, right? But we're talking about a missile that could theoretically deliver a nuclear weapon to Washington, D.C., which of course would lead to the complete annihilation of North Korea. But that's cold comfort to the United States and cold comfort to South Korea, which no doubt would be eliminated as well. So although this is in some ways a return to just the usual cycle of provocation, I mean, is there something legitimately new and potentially destabilizing about North Korea having the ability to strike the United States?
Well, certainly, yeah, certainly it's a big step forward in terms of them being able to deliver a nuclear warhead, right? Which is the whole enterprise here and the whole point. And so it does matter for sure that this version of the Hwasong-17 being tested was successful. But I guess then the question I always have is, what's the appropriate response, right? So then the appropriate response, one of the favorite routes, as we've already talked about, is kind of the U.S. asking China and Russia to leverage. The other response is kind of like continue the joint military exercises with South Korea. The terminal high altitude defense system in South Korea right now is also in theory to try and block any sort of missiles that might go out and intercept it before it gets far off the peninsula. So that's going on. But a lot of those things, well, the first one of Russia and China don't seem to work because Russia and China aren't going to do anything about that. And then the second kind of we need to be doing other things to strengthen our presence in the Korean Peninsula often just provokes them even farther and pushes them farther down the line of let's do more testing. And I think that that goes to this asymmetry problem, right? Because the US and South Korea are working with conventional warfare a lot of times, right? We're talking about F-16s, we're talking about submarines, we're talking about on the ground military power, whereas the only thing that North Korea has is the nuclear option, literally. And so whenever I see this happening, it's just striking that there are a bunch of different avenues that we try and counteract North Korea's moving forward of their nuclear program. But North Korea, the only thing they can do is just continue their nuclear program. So it just pushes us closer and closer to the brink. So, and if you ask me, no one asked me, but if you ask me about what we should be doing overall to...
I'm asking you. You're officially being asked. Okay. Go for it.
Well, I think if we want to really respond to North Korea and the North Korean problem, I do think it's an investment of having, like, you know, diplomatic relations. Everyone kind of wants to make fun of that, but actually having lines of communication going so that it's a bottom-up approach to denuclearizing the peninsula and having that be an ongoing conversation and not just in response to and sanctioning of North Korea. I think that is a longstanding project that, again, different administrations have different perspectives on that. But as a general matter, I think in 2005, 2006, with the six-party talks that were happening, there was a lot of progress being made back then. But once those started deteriorating, I don't think we've ever really returned since to this kind of keeping lines of communication open and actually trying, like, at lower levels, not going straight to Kim Jong-un, but like talking to diplomats and having these relations continuing forward as a steady state, going back to something like that, and really trying to build denuclearization as a longstanding project as opposed to being reactionary or just combative on the front level. I think that's kind of, I would love to see a response like that.
Yeah, you know, I really think you hit on kind of a conundrum that both the Obama administration, the Trump administration, and now the Biden administration have found themselves in, and to some extent the Bush administration, Clinton administration before them, is that, so I don't think there is actually an easy path out of this particular conundrum. I think your point on engagement is a good one, but that's about creating opportunities for a path, right? Like creating situations where you can see mutual willingness to move towards some, you know, non-zero sum outcome manifest themselves. But the problem is that where you've seen major investments be outlaid, you saw a major one by the Clinton administration, right, which led to a substantial degree of re-engagement, lightening of sanctions, and then a quick slide back to by North Korea, back towards a nuclear weapon program, back towards a variety of behaviors that at least the Clinton administration had been under the understanding had been kind of taken off the table by, or at least substantially limited by the behavior. And the leverage was the same. Like, you have this nuclear potential at the time, like realized now, or that even a nuclear capability may be developing one at the time. And that's a point of leverage that keeps coming back when you're in a situation where there's really nothing you can do. And that's the regime's main sort of avenue. The Biden administration, you know, has actually come out as and said, I remember hearing people from the National Security Council kind of quoted saying, we're trying to split the difference between Trump and Obama, right? Obama had a kind of, there's nothing we can do about this. So the best thing we can do is, you know, stop rewarding North Korean brinksmanship by seeing it as a reason to engage, instead keep sustained pressure on and assume the consequences of that pressure are going to build. To some extent it did domestically, but the cost of most economic sanctions are borne most heavily by the public, not by the elites in charge of the country. That's particularly true in North Korea. Then the Trump administration, initially very hostile, and I think this is where like the threat to hit the United States comes in. If you remember, there was a long debate of whether the Trump administration would consider a bloody nose kind of strike on North Korea in 2017, when there was a really heated rhetoric before the Trump administration completely reversed course and said, no, we're going to do high level engagement. Really interesting. I still would love to see a explanation of exactly what led to that complete reversal of course. But, you know, nonetheless, it did lead to this kind of engagement and maybe avenues of communication, but at this very high level. And it's not clear what really that led either. Part of that's because I'm not sure they really had a strategic vision about where it was going to lead. But it also just wasn't done with anything specific in mind. And I'm not sure, I think you hit on something really astute here, Heyman, where you don't know really what the Biden administration splitting difference is going to look like. Are we just talking about high-level talks in addition to like not like slow high-level talks instead of being very aggressive and seeking like leader-to-leader summits, slow climbs up the ladder? The truth is, like, in my understanding, and I'm not an expert, North Korea has been very resistant to that because they really want to see a degree of high-level engagement. I think because for them, like, that's the thing that they're kind of angling for. Sanctions relief would be great, but in the first case, they want to look like they're getting the United States to capitulate and kind of come to the table and that they have that strength. Maybe that's worth kind of giving up a little bit. Like, maybe that's a trade-off, and I was not one who was overly critical of the Trump administration in pursuing those engagements, because I think there are reasons to do them at a variety of levels where you can. But I wouldn't be too sanguine about there being like an easy out here. And I think that's the reason why you don't see people being willing to make much of an investment in this topic in recent administrations, except for the weird kind of Trump effort, because it's not clear that the payoff is likely to be that high. The incentive structure just doesn't seem there either for North Korea. I will say, you know, my inclination is that I think this is probably a good example of a case where sanctions just have proven very ineffective, because if anything, they really reinforce the hierarchy of authority within North Korea, right? Like, no one else in North Korea, except for the regime, has really any economic power, political power, in part because they can't engage in trade or otherwise kind of advance their lives other than through the regime. Sanctions double down on that authority to some extent, because the regime controls those illicit means by which they can actually develop and function as a national economy, and ties to China, which are essential, all the sort of avenues. Maybe this is a case where you provide sanctions relief and you try and structure it in a way that begins to empower other folks in North Korea, develop a local economy that's not contingent upon the state. Again, try and get those conditions that we usually associate with more robust political change to cultivate in North Korea over time. But even that is just speculative. There's no real easy way out. And I think that is not an unreasonable reason why administrations are so hesitant to make a big public commitment to this particular issue.
Yeah, no, that's super fair. And far be it from me to suggest that it's an easy solution or that there is certain a path forward that is particularly right. I just think that, you know, if we think about where we are, again, as Alan brought up, this is a big deal insofar as it's a new capability to bring a warhead. And by the way, I want to be clear that just because they have the ICBM technology and just because they have a warhead does not mean that they can actually deliver. Like, those two things coordinating too, is there's probably a longer way to go. But the fact that they have this new technology is a big deal. And so the question becomes, why would we want to respond in any way other than trying to like normalize relations? Like, I'm not suggesting that we should try and assuage them and that we need to be kind of bowing down to what is ultimately terrible things that they're doing. But engagement has, as a general matter, decreased. And there was a time back in the early 2000s or mid-2000s that we were kind of close to having some sort of six-party agreement. So I think that having lower level diplomatic talks that continue to be like open lines of communication and engagement that isn't just because they're testing and because they're getting closer, but actually because we want to finally resolve this ongoing conflict over 50 years. I think that kind of attitude or that willingness to want to bring North Korea back into the global community is something that we might consider nowadays, given the fact that they're getting so close. So I think that's all I'm saying. And I think that, again, because it's just such an asymmetric situation where the U.S. and South Korea can do things that are strategic in the Pacific area that, you know, seems pretty normal, like joint exercises and continuing to build capability in that region is something we should be doing and is normal. But again, the only way that North Korea really is able to respond to those things is just going more and more and more nuclear. So that kind of asymmetry, to me at least, signals a real impetus to try and restart engagement and find different avenues than doing the whole, let's go to the UN Security Council and have them condemn again for however manyth time and ask Russia and China, who will not do that.
To add, to pivot a little bit, I just wanted to cover Kim Jong-un bringing his daughter to the launch, which I found to be very confusing. But I just wanted to add that I don't think that this was a daddy-daughter day for Kim Jong-un. Let's go look at missiles. I don't think, though, that that was for us, I think, or like from an international perspective, I think that it's probably messaging for the North Korean people of longevity. You know, North Korea is a hereditary dictatorship, and I think it's just a message to the people about strength, and this is our successful missile launch, and it's going to, I think it's just a signal to them about the strength of North Korea for the future and prosperity.
Well, I just wanted to ask, I mean, do we know, is the daughter his only child? And if so, is, okay, so no. Yes, I'm seeing some head shaking. I don't know what the sort of gender norms and gender politics are in North Korea. I mean, it would be an interesting win for diversity, though, you know, ultimately not that great if the next murderous dictator of North Korea was a woman. I suspect that is probably not the case, just given what we know about how these sort of autocratic hereditary monarchies tend to work.
Yeah, no, she's not the only one. It's strange. She's actually the second daughter.
I almost feel bad for the first daughter. Yeah, why doesn't she get to go to the daddy-daughter ICBM day at school?
Yeah, there's a lot of intrigue around the whole thing, and it is, you're right to think about it as a like culturally, I feel like it does make sense to like kind of bring the eldest in. And but I think it is a little too early to think about if there was more messaging on this than maybe what Catherine was suggesting is just a general like longevity thing. But, you know, people have been talking about, oh, are they trying to introduce the heir? Are they trying to create a line of succession? Like, as we mentioned, Alan, I think you told us he's 38. Like he's not going anywhere. I don't think that it's, I think that some things I've seen out there about, you know, this being a signal for the line of succession is probably a little bit premature. But yeah, it definitely does seem to be, you know, showing the North Korean people that this is kind of for something bigger. And it kind of is evocative of, I guess, this very, like, anytime North Korea and nuclear weapons come out, I'm just reminded of the fact that this is a hermit kingdom that really is clinging on to dear life with this one big weapon that it has, the nuclear weapon, that the only reason it sees itself as being able to survive in this moment and not be annihilated by external powers. So I do think it does have a lot of layers to it. I don't presume to know what the intention was at all, but there's a lot baked into the cake, I think, for that. Yeah.
Well, folks, we'll have to leave the conversation there for now, but this would not be Rational Security if we did not bring you some object lessons to ponder over until we are back with you next week. Alan, why don't you get us started?
So the Lawfare Slack contains multitudes, all of which are wonderful. But one of my favorite corners of the Lawfare Slack is our Lawfare Dependents channel, where we post pictures of our dependents, which is usually like boring stuff like children and the occasional dog. But sometimes you get a really fun Lawfare Dependents entry. And the latest one, and this is my object lesson, is from our very own Catherine Pompilio. And it is her parrot, Moby. And there's just an amazing picture of just this very... I don't know. I always find parrots to look very intelligent and thoughtful and kind of inquisitive, peeking up over her laptop, which has the Lawfare, which is open to the Lawfare site. So I think with Catherine's permission, we will post that to Twitter. And that is my object lesson, the greatest Lawfare dependent of all time, the parrot.
Maybe. Absolutely. Maybe some Patreon content will be him dancing to Gangnam Style, because he does that a lot.
The dream. I have to say, I find birds somewhere between creepy and terrifying. I don't know why. I think it's something built into like my dinosaur DNA.
Yeah, it's because they're dinosaurs. Ancestors. It's because birds are dinosaurs.
Yeah, all birds. I'm like, even chickens. I'm like, I don't trust you. You got something going on back there. You got that predatory look in your eyes. But I'm sure the parrot is very nice, Catherine. I would not cast aspersions on them specifically.
No, he's crazy, but he's an African gray, and I'm pretty sure that they're the only types of parrots that can mimic voices exactly. Oh, wow. So he's creepy in the way in that he mimics my voice, my stepdad, my mom. When I was a child, he used to scream for my mother in my voice.
Wow, and that's now crazy.
Now he coughs and sets his alarm and lives his little birdie life. We had Christopher Jackson, who played George Washington in Hamilton, come to my house for a fundraiser that we were doing for the community college here. And he was singing in my living room, and Moby's in my kitchen. And Moby was whistling along to Christopher Jackson and screaming over him while singing. So Moby is actually an unofficial Hamilton cast member as well because of that. So he's a pretty special bird. Yeah.
If only I could imitate his voice, that'd be perfect. That'd be amazing.
a parrot of many talents.
Exactly. Well, for my object lesson, I'm going back to the obituary pages, for better or for worse. I feel like I've been doing this a lot lately, talking about people who have passed away. So apologies, but I'm going to do one more. Michael Gerson passed away, who is a columnist for the Washington Post, a former Bush administration, George W. Bush administration speechwriter. I am a DC local, and I've read the Washington Post and probably follow the columnists more than your average person, even though there are plenty of columnists I don't particularly like. And he wrote a lot of things I don't particularly agree with, but I always found him very readable and interesting and more thoughtful than a lot of folks. And I was sad to see he had passed away. And then somebody pointed me to a column he wrote that is of a brand that I don't usually read these sorts of columns, but I always found his fairly reflective, which are kind of the life columns about reflecting on something of a more universal experience. And he wrote this one about his youngest son going to college that I thought was actually like a really touching, wonderful reflection on parenthood and dying, which the two things kind of go hand in hand. And so I wanted to I'm going to read the part of it that I was most struck by, because I thought it was really, really exceptional. Oh, he's describing how his son is going to be like a little homesick. He says, "But with due respect to my son's feelings, I have the worst of it. I know something he doesn't, not quite a secret, but incomprehensible to the young. He is experiencing the adjustments that come with beginnings. His life is starting for real. I have begun the letting go. Put another way, he has a wonderful future in which my part naturally diminishes. I have no possible future that is better without him close. There's no use brooding about it. I'm sure my father realized it at a similar moment, and I certainly didn't notice or empathize. At first, he was a giant who held my hand and filled my sky, then a middle-aged man who paid my bills, now, decades after his passing, a much-loved shadow. But I can remember the last time I hugged him in the front hallway of his home, where I always had a room. It is a memory of warmth. I can only hope to leave my son the same. Parenthood offers many lessons in patience and sacrifice, but ultimately it is a lesson in humility. The very best thing about your life is a short stage in someone else's story, and it is enough." I thought that was quite striking and lovely and brought me to tears a little bit. That's pretty easy to do these days about parenthood related things. So I thought I would share on this occasion of his passing. Catherine, what do you have for us in terms of object lessons? Hopefully something more upbeat.
A little bit. So fun fact about me is that anytime that I need to focus, I'm really helped out by listening to jazz or like smooth jazz. It's how I wrote my entire undergraduate thesis. It's how I spend all of my time editing for Lawfare and writing.
I love it.
Yeah. Smooth jazz, like Kenny G.
Like Kenny, like saxophone, oh, coffee shop.
Soprano saxophone, to be clear.
Yeah.
It has to be soprano saxophone.
Yeah, exactly. I'm pretty sure my Spotify analytics are going to be just like probably thousands of hours of jazz. But a friend sent to me a couple weeks ago, it's an album on Spotify called Ethio Peaks, Ethio Jazz, 1969 to 1974. And it is the weirdest, funkiest Ethiopian jazz. And I would 10 out of 10 recommend. It has also gotten me through all of the editing this week, and it's fantastic. So yeah, that's my object lesson.
That is pretty amazing. I will say, if folks have not checked it out, I don't know if it's on Spotify, actually. I used to have it on another musical service, but the Smithsonian Folkways Collection, which is an amazing collection of a lot of Americana-type music, but also does a fair amount of like international historical periods. And it does a great job capturing like popular music, including a lot of jazz from like the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, and then like really cool funk and disco music from the 70s, 80s, and 90s from different corners of the world. That is an amazing collection of stuff like that. And that sounds like right up its alley. And something I used to spend a lot of time when I was writing papers in my 20s digging into that. Maybe it's time for me to turn back to my Folkways collection at some point. Heyman, what do you have for us this week?
So I have a performance that I saw. It's called Trojan Women. It's based on the Euripides play about the women survivors after the sacking of Troy. And it's interesting because this like onstage version of the musical is the second version that the Singaporean director has done for this interpretation. He first did one in Singapore, and then this one is showing I saw it in Brooklyn, and it's the Korean kind of twist on the Trojan women. So he's used the Trojan women's story as a kind of medium to talk about the struggles that women have to go through or went through after all of their husbands and sons were killed in war, and kind of telling the story about women survivors of war. And so this version was done through pansori, which is a ancient storytelling kind of Korean opera style form of performance. And it, I think, was meant to be a kind of proxy for the experience of comfort women in Korea. And it was beautifully done. And I thought it was just a great mix of the ancient storytelling medium and a traditional Greek play, but also transposing that onto a different culture. And they also had the stage that was interactive and had English translation, so it was very accessible. And it was one of the first performances that I'd seen recently that I think kind of brought me to tears almost. It was very intense. So something that I would definitely recommend if you're ever in a city that can that will show you something, one of the renditions of the Trojan Woman play. Or I don't know, it's a play. It's a musical, I guess.
Very cool. Yes, we will have to hope they bring the tour to DC and Minnesota and other corners where the Lawfare team resides. Until then, that brings us to the end of this week's episode. Rational Security 2.0 is like its forebear, a production of Lawfare. Follow us on Twitter at RETL Security. Be sure to leave a rating or review wherever you might be listening. While you're at it, visit lawfareblog.com for our show page with links to past episodes, for our written work and the written work of other Lawfare contributors, and for information on Lawfare's other podcast series. And be sure to sign up to become a material supporter of Lawfare on Patreon for an ad-free version of this podcast and other special benefits. Our audio engineer and producer this week was Ian Enright of Goat Rodeo, and our music, as always, was performed by Sophia Yan. We were once again edited by the wonderful Jenpacha Howell. On behalf of my co-host Alan, not Quinta, this week, and our special guests, Catherine and Heyman, I am Scott R. Anderson, and we will talk to you next week. Till then, goodbye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.